Did you eat means I love you. I show up at your back door with a bento box of pot stickers. I thought you were inviting me to tea, so I had to bring something. Only to find that you were not really inviting me to tea, the pot stickers forgotten on your kitchen counter as our tongues tangle on the couch. I am so nervous I can never eat around you. A handsome young scholar who has started showing up at my back door asks me, between plates of mango mochi and taro steam buns and curry beef pastries, "Why are you always trying to feed me?" I'm Chinese. I can't help myself. This is what we do. We feed people. As I place another plate of summer rolls before him. The Peace Corps volunteers in Kathmandu are laughing about the Nepali families who keep asking them, "Did you eat rice yet? Bat kanubayo?" "No, I had noodles." "Wrong answer." "Is the salt okay?" "Nun tikcha." "No, a little too salty." Again, wrong answer. The young Americans hear the words, but they do not understand. Am I the only one here not laughing? It is the same in Chinese. Ni chi fan le ma? Have you eaten yet? And who can forget the soy sauce scene in the Joy Luck Club? Regardless of whether you answer yes or no, and your answer should always be yes, by the way, the aunties will sit you down at the table with a fresh bowl of rice for more. As the Black Lava t-shirt says, "Did you eat?" means I love you. Poignant truth, precarious you, and preparing for the Sriracha apocalypse. An excerpt. My parents wake me in the middle of the night. "Chilai, chilai, hurry. Only enough time to grab my favorite doll, and I have been bundled, bleary-eyed, into the car, and we are driving. Through the three tunnels that mark the way, then burst into the light and cacophony that is old L.A. Chinatown at midnight. We come in through the back door, through the kitchen, just past the uncles with their giant woks and oil. Ta! Our eyes adjust to the darkness of the restaurant, and then, aunties, uncles, little friends, xiaoye time. And that means oa, xiaolongbao, zhuer, hongyou chaoshou, zhou. But first, we order xiangpian cha, which I always thought was champagne tea, which makes sense. These days, teenage girls gather around my kitchen table, and I ply them with mango mochi and xiangpian cha, pretending not to eavesdrop as they celebrate college admissions. "I got into MIT!" Gasp over who is sending whom naked Snapchats. "Ew!" And cry over. My mom says I'm not allowed to date those steezy, third-generation, snapback-wearing California Asian boys with the expensive shoes. Crying on airplanes. Whenever I hear children crying on airplanes, I always laugh. Been there, done that. Ain't got to worry about that no more. Not that my kids ever cried on airplanes. I laugh because I don't have to carry two extra changes of clothing in case they throw up on me twice. I don't have to walk laps up and down the aisle with restless toddlers. I don't have to carry extra sweaters, blankets, clothes, snacks, books, games, toys, videos, headphones, batteries, socks. I don't have to try to sleep with little feet in my ears and elbows in my boob. I don't have to carefully pack and double-check all the children's suitcases and carry-ons so that someone doesn't try to sneak on her triathlon medal in order to test TSA's metal detectors. I'm done. But this summer, when I hear little voices crying on airplanes, all I can think about are the cries of those 2,300 little kids ripped from their parents' arms and shipped on cold metal airplanes across the country to literally who knows where. Cold air blowing on top of their heads as they fasten their seatbelts and return their tray tables to the upright position. When all their parents wanted was what every parent wants: asylum, safety, freedom. And here I am, worrying about my 18-year-old daughter sitting alone, a few rows behind me. And I'm done. Tsundere pride, or you are so prickly, an excerpt. Teenage girls gather around my kitchen table, making mochi and crying over boys. I hear the same useless advice that my girlfriends give to me. Boys are dumb, let him go. One teenager draws a diagram in the scattered mochiko to explain the seriousness of the situation. A loves B, who loves C, who is going out with D, who cheated on E in seventh grade, whatever that means, who made a pass at F, who got herpes from G, who is not allowed to date but likes H, who might be gay, and has a crush on J, who held hands with K, who is chatting with L on Facebook, who follows M on Tumblr, who keeps texting A at midnight. When one girl exclaims, "I wish they would just all go to Antarctica," another one answers, "That's chill." Whatever happened to Wang Dazhong? Whatever happened to Wang Dazhong? We meet in San Jose on the first day of Saturday morning Chinese school, on the pages of Book 1, Chapter 1, of the same textbook they use in Taiwan. Instead of see Dick run, run Dick run, we walk to school with Wang Dazhong. This is my book bag. This is my pen. This is my chair. We all rise and bow to the teacher together as she enters our classroom. Good morning, teacher. Good morning, students. Are you Wang Dazhong? Yes, I am Wang Dazhong. My parents were born in China, grew up in Taiwan, then came to America for graduate school, like so many of that generation. Pushed by war, pulled by education and opportunity, made a life among silicon chips and prune orchards. But none of us are Taiwanese, really. We are Waisenren, from the outer provinces. Outsiders there, outsiders here. I have only been to Taiwan twice, once when I was 3 and once when I was 19. I ate fresh shaobing youtiao hot out of the oil and dipped in fresh doujiang early in the morning mist. I watched a Taichung University talent show where a cute boy with a guitar sang about the boxer and the come-ons from the horse on 7th Avenue. My new friends laughed when I mixed up new vocabulary words, an quan mao and bao xian tao, tong wu and tong xing. I like to say that we are Chinese by way of Taiwan. And the nice white ladies at school say, "Oh, I love Thailand." With his iconic short shorts, white sneakers, and green book bag, we knew Wang Dazhong. Not a hair out of place, Wang Dazhong is always nice, always polite, always obedient and guai. Wang Dazhong always knew the right thing to do, and he never had any of the problems we did with not fitting in with the American kids at school, or being embarrassed by our Taiwanese designer knockoffs, or fighting with our parents who just did not understand. We were bad Chinese school students who wrote our Chinese school homework every Friday night with a Chinese dictionary on one side and mom on the other side. Every Saturday morning, we guessed our way through exams with radicals and homonyms. We invoked his name in every sentence, paragraph, essay, speech, and skit that we wrote as we slogged through our Chinese school childhoods together, chapter after chapter, textbook after Overseas Chinese Affairs Commission's textbook. Whenever we needed an old friend whose name we knew, we could write. Whenever we needed an old friend to walk with us. Wang Dazhong. Once, when talking to my 11-year-old son, who we all call little brother, about how our family crossed the Strait of Taiwan after the war, and clarifying the difference between straight, S-T-R-A-I-T, and straight, S-T-R-A-I-G-H-T, he suddenly burst out, "What? Taiwan is an island?" "You don't know that Taiwan is an island? Is that why there's that chili pepper on all our Taiwan keychains?" Aiya, how did I forget to teach him that Taiwan is an island? But he knows Wang Dazhong. another generation later, with the same Overseas Chinese Affairs Commission textbooks from Taiwan, Wang Dazhong comes to life yet again in Little Brother's Chinese school storytelling competitions, as he jokes about Bo Pa Ma Fe, references the night markets, and how Qiu Fen is the model for Miyazaki's Spirited Away, and sings about the beautiful Alishan Mountains, all places he has never walked. Yet he sings, Alishan di guniang, mei ru shui ya. Alishan di shaonian, zhuang ru shan. Today, a refugee boy from a landlocked country calls me island girl as we walk, and I wonder how the beautiful island of Formosa walks within me across legacies of colonialism, occupation, transnational migration, immigration, resistance, and revolution. Where are we from? Where are we really from? Not a hair out of place. Wang Dazhong is always nice, always polite, always obedient and guai. Even without his iconic short shorts, white sneakers, and green book bag, I look in the mirror and recognize his black hair with a hint of curl. Golden brown skin, fair in the sunlight, square rim glasses. But this is not the idyllic Taiwan of our parents' childhood stories. Or maybe it never was. Are you a student? The teacher asks. Yes, I am a student, he replies. Am I a student? The teacher asks. No, you are the teacher, he says. I wonder what he would say to the children with the sunflowers in their hands, walking to the American border seeking asylum. We are hashtag more than boba. And so Wang Dazhong walks with me still as I learn to write my life with bigger words and more complicated characters every day. You cannot resist me when my hair is in braids. Sitting in Sweetwater's cafe for the afternoon with a pot of Earl Grey tea, trying to write, trying to put off looking for a day job, trying to figure out how to construct a new beginning out of all this financial ruin, all the while watching the cute boys walk past my window on this cold gray day, wishing for some handsome young professor to walk in and flirt with me for a bit. I've got my hair in braids today. You cannot resist me when my hair is in braids. Grandfather walking. 1. In my child's eye, I see my grandfather as a young man walking. Walking from Jining to Beiping, then on to Nanjing. Early morning mist hanging low on the fields. Rucksack slung over his shoulder. His mother's steam buns and dumplings packed safely away. Long legs, slim frame, only a scarf to protect him from the Inner Mongolian cold. 1931. I know that is improbable. That the distance must be too far to walk. He must have taken a train, or hopped a truck at some point. But when I examine the old train maps, it does not look like the train even reached that far in 1931. I wonder how common were passing trucks in those days. How long would it take to travel such a distance? Today it is 12 hours by train, overnight, in a hard sleeper. I do not even know the questions to ask. All I know is that as the oldest son of the second wife, his future had been laid out for him. A small plot of land, the family home, farming, hard farming. Educated in the classics, Confucius and Mencius, he had just graduated from teacher's high school, but he did not want to teach. He did not want to farm. At 18, who can imagine a lifetime of farming stretching out before him? So he set off to join the army, and he walked. 2. He was sitting in the army cafeteria eating lunch with his buddies one day when Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek walked in and pointed at a group of them sitting together and said, "I need some volunteers for the Air Force. You guys there look good. Come with me." Suddenly, from the Officers' Academy, 9th class, he went to the Air Force, 5th class, 1936. He only ever told funny stories about the Sino-Japanese War, World War II, the Chinese Civil War. The broader strokes I had to learn from history books written in English from white male professors. 1931 Manchurian Incident, 1937 Marco Polo Bridge Incident, 1941 Pearl Harbor, 1945 Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 1949 Liberation, Defeat, Communists, Taiwan. He told me about the time his plane was shot down by the Japanese and he had to parachute out of his burning plane. Then he looked down and he realized that he was about to parachute into a lake. He did not know how to swim. Another time, it was a warm, sunny day, and he got into his plane very relaxed in his shirt sleeves. As he casually practiced his maneuvers, he started to turn his plane upside down. With no cover, no roof, he suddenly realized that he had forgotten to put on his seatbelt when he started to fall out of his own plane. When telling us his war stories, he always acted out how he flew his fighter plane, two hands on the yoke, eyes steady, looking back over his shoulder as a squadron of Japanese planes suddenly appeared all around him, his mouth open screaming as he turned hard, then dived down, all of our bodies shuddering along with the plane. Then he would show us the bullet that was taken out of his side and let us grandkids put our hands in his scar. 3. August 29, 1938. Everyone knows about my grandmother's great love of sweets. Hongdou, chocolate, cream puffs, anything sweet. So no surprise that she spent a lot of time at the dentist's office. His teeth had been injured while parachuting out of a burning plane, so he took 3 weeks off to get some dental work done in Chengdu. In the waiting room of the dentist's office, he saw a beautiful girl in a qipao, only 15 years old, round face, pouty lips, two schoolgirl braids, quietly reading a book. Too shy to ask her directly, his friend asked to see the book she was reading, and when they returned the book to her, a love letter hid in its pages. When I ask my mother what happened next, she just laughs. They spent a lot of time at the dentist's office. Everything happened there. Next to the dentist's office was Qingrendao, Lover's Lane, where they walked in the shade of the trees after their appointments and talked about the books they read. My aunties call it the dental romance. When her mother, my great mother, learned that they wanted to be married, she agreed at first, but then she changed her mind. So many in the Air Force died when their planes were shot down, no way to survive a crash. She did not want her third daughter to be a young widow. She moved the entire family, 9 children, to another city so that he would not be able to find her. But he was persistent. He pursued her to the other city. As the incredibly romantic movie version plays out in my imagination, him finding an empty house, running through deserted alleyways, frantically asking all the neighbors, following a trail of faltering clues, shouting her name into the distance, I ask my mother, however did he find them? My mother laughs. She told him where to find them. 4. More family stories. One day, he did not fly because he had a cold. All the planes that went up that day were shot down. Not one of his buddies came back. He lived because he had a cold. He had the most Purple Hearts of anyone in the Nationalist Air Force, simply because he lived. Whenever he heard that friends were struggling, he hid whatever money he had on him under his teacup, under his plate, for them to find later, after he had gone. When I write an article about Connie Chung years later, he tells me that he trained in Texas. Connie Chung's father was the translator and liaison. I know Chinese families. I'm sure he was invited to their home for a meal. I know how he was with all his grandkids. I'm sure that he bounced baby Connie, the youngest of 10 children and the only Chung child born in America, on his knee. I tell Connie Chung this story. His records tell me that he was in Calcutta at the end of World War II. In August 1945, he traveled by ship with 56 students from Kunming to Calcutta to America. Their ship passed Sri Lanka, crossed the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, the Atlantic Ocean, landing in New York. They took a train to Montgomery, Alabama in 1945, and then to San Antonio, Texas, and later to Phoenix, Arizona. They spent a year training with the American military as allies. I wish I had known to ask him about that train ride through the American South in 1945. 5. At the end of the Chinese Civil War, he flew most of my grandmother's large family out of China into Taiwan, but he almost did not make it out himself. That last night in China, he had to wait for an underground informant who was late, very late, and badly wounded. He waited in the dark that night, wondering if he should just leave, but knowing that if he did, it would mean death for the fellow they left behind. They made it to the airfield with 10 minutes to spare. He flew the last plane out of China in 1949. After the family moved to Taiwan, he continued to move up the ranks and became a major general and a vice chancellor of the Air Force Academy, 40 medals across his chest. By then, his 6 daughters were vivacious teenage girls and young women, full of chaos and commotion. I grew up on stories about boys in love tying their rivals to the tree in front of their house, as well as stories of him chasing down boys in the middle of the night with his gun, in full uniform, medals flying. After his daughters started going to America for graduate school, he moved to Canada and opened a small lunch cafe, serving sandwiches and dumplings, to set up his only son for a certain future, a future his son cannot imagine living. I'm the first in the family to take the train back to his old home in Inner Mongolia since 1949. I'm the same age he was when he left, but I am young and dumb and more concerned with flirting with the cute boys from Singapore that I met on the train. I visit his old home in the country where several families now live. I take a picture of the well, which he recognizes. I stare at an ancient woman's tiny bound feet, but he does not remember who she is. I sleep on a huge kang, the heat from the cook stove routed underneath. We make dumplings together at each relative's house. Relatives laugh at my poor dumpling folding technique and how I say please and thank you too much. So many relatives, though, all hugging and touching and crying over me. Lots of whispered gossip I only partly understand through their accents. At one point, I cannot take it anymore and grab a bicycle to escape for an hour. My grandfather's younger brother runs down the lane after me, crying. I find my way to a local museum in Huhuhot, where I happen to run into the cute boys from Singapore, and I pour out my stories in a torrent of English until I'm empty, quiet. Worried about how the government might use him for propaganda, it is not until he is 80 years old that he dares to go back himself. 6. At his funeral, one of his military friends spoke about how he was always able to find a steam bun or two as he walked. People enjoyed his friendly charm, how happy to share what they had with him. He hid these in his pockets until he ran into another northerner, at which point he would slip the precious treasure into the other's appreciative hands. Everyone, so far from home. I remember how he always had to have at least one meal a day that was wheat, steam buns, noodles, bing, dumplings, or else he did not feel full. Today, 2 continents and 3 lifetimes away, I make steamed taro buns for my children for breakfast, noodle soup for lunch, dumplings for dinner. Rice is okay, but we are northerners. We have to have bread and noodles, mian shi. I tell them stories of their great-grandfather, the adventurer, the war hero, the martial artist, the calligrapher, the one who told me about the great monkey king and who taught me how to handle a sword. A handsome young man walks into my house and shakes off the dust of his war zones, the dirt of his refugee camps. His wars are fought with computers, statistical modeling, satellite phones, food, and medicine. He has seen terrible things, but he only tells me the funny stories. The rest I gleaned from the news. He puts away his guns, but is fascinated by the swords he finds in every room of my house. Katana, jian, changdao, dadao, saber, broadsword, spears. I show him my grandfather's sword, take it out from the embroidered box, the ornate scabbard heavy in my hand. It's like a lightsaber. Oh, we have those too. Unlike some of his sincere friends, I do not worry about him. I do not ask where he's headed. I do not ask when he will return. I know he can handle himself, that this is the story he must write. I sense a moment of vulnerability behind his hubris, and I'm so surprised that I wrap my arms around it, want to create a space of lightness for him to simply be. But the phone rings, and the walls go up, and he's gone. As he leaves me once again, I see him in my mind's eye, walking away in the distance, fog heavy on the trees by the airport, on the cities in which he works, long legs, slim frame, only a scarf to protect him from the cold. Together we walk. Academic love affair. Two Asian American girlfriends sit in the window of Eastern Accents, discussing their latest loves over laptops and lattes. One friend squeals with delight while showing off the latest email from him, knocking over the small pile of lit books precariously perched on the round table when spinning her laptop back around. The other one adjusts her academically black-rimmed glasses skeptically. This is the nerdiest love affair I ever heard of. You know, normal people send each other flowers. You two send each other your essays. The arteries of our city. Dear Didi, Didi, I love you. Didi, I always see you everywhere I go. Love, Karina. 3-year-old little brother's first love letter from a girl in his class. She always sees him everywhere she goes. We have run into her exactly once at the YMCA for swim class. Love is so easily satisfied at 3. Why is it I never see you anywhere I go? Traveling along the arteries of our city, why do our paths never cross? I drive south on Huron Parkway while you drive north on Division. I head west on Washtenaw and Stadium as you head east over the Broadway Bridge onto Plymouth Road. North on Main, south on Earhart, east on Geddes, and west on Hill. Circling, always circling, for years circling around the heartbeat of our city. Same sunsets, same full moons, but our timing not quite right. I head downtown in the mornings. You go only at night. I am at the Y on Mondays in the pool. You are there Thursdays on the track. I go to Sweetwater's Cafe for the poetry on Tuesdays, but on Tuesdays you are having dinner 2 blocks away at Kai Gardens. Eastern Accents Bakery is a constant, but I sit back in the kitchen with the owners. You sit only in the front window with the kung fu guys. The events to which I think you certainly must come are the ones to which you send substitutes. How can it be that we have been in this city together for so many years and never accidentally met? My time is so limited, I sometimes worry that I'm turning into a crazy stalker, obsessed with schedules, worried about logistics, searching for windows of opportunity, longing to simply inhabit the same space as you for a few precious moments, to touch the possibility of your face. Yet we pass as shadows, different times, different days. Even virtually we miss. I email you long, wordy, circling poems at 4 a.m. You respond with pithy one-line jests after 11 p.m. No chance for IM chats or text messaging. We do not even inhabit wakefulness at the same times. This might as well be a Star Trek episode about parallel universes, sending our words out into the darkness, out across time and space. Once I saw you on a street corner at Liberty and Main, checking out the ferry door at Salo-Shavel Gallery. I ran up from behind and threw my arms around your neck for all the world to see. At last, I have found you. At last, you exist. Then he turned, and it wasn't you. Not even close. Pardon me, sir. Wishful thinking, I guess. I kissed the puzzled man on the cheek for good measure and smiled as I looked back, walking away in my boots. I have been traveling on my own for so long that I cannot even imagine what it would feel like to fly with another. What would it mean to have you coursing through the arteries of my life? The traveler. The traveler was just passing through when he spent the night at our house on White Street. An old friend of my anthropologist's housemate, he sweeps into town once a year to pick up some Stilton at Zingerman's on his way up north to check in with his mother. With the fireplace burning behind him, he holds court while sitting cross-legged on the rug. He speaks of gods and goddesses, dakinis and yogis, magical disappearing waterfalls, endless mist. His voice full of drama, he describes the monkeys scurrying around the dusty temples in Kathmandu, drinking apple brandy with the princes of Mustang, wandering lost in the empty monasteries of Tibet. A halo of fire surrounds his head, adding intensity to his tales while all the skinny young anthro girls gather closer to his knees. I stare at the turquoise wrapped around his throat. I know how this story is going to end. Bored, I wander into the kitchen to make a cup of genmai tea. Suddenly, he is in front of me, leaning one hand against the wall, using the other to smooth down his cascading ringlets, asking so coolly, if I am spirit or fairy trying to lure him down into the mouth of the volcano. Oh, please. I cannot get past him in the narrow doorway, so I make up some story about how I am a Mongolian princess on one side, a Silicon Valley computer heiress on the other. He is entranced. He leans over closer and closer. My story reminds him of the time he led a group of intoxicated Harvard alums on a tour of Ulaanbaatar. Tired of listening to him talk about himself, I reach up to take the turquoise in my mouth and with a quick tug, rip it right off his neck. Then I smile coyly and whisper into his ear to go up the stairs into the attic room. I'll bring up the good Calvados. I let my long black hair linger against his cheek. I don't tell him that that's Henry's room or that I don't drink, not since that night in Huhuhota anyway. As I listen to him clomping greedily up the stairs, I grab my red silk mianpao that I picked up in Hong Kong last year, drop the turquoise into my left pocket, and steal out the back door to go to the grad library for the night. Ready to take flight. Spotted. Flying down Huron Parkway, with bright orange helmet, dark red sunglasses, and fluttering turquoise cape. One young superhero in training, on the back of his mother's blue and gold cruiser bike, arms up, ready to take flight. Running Hero. A running story for you. 5-year-old little brother and I are walking towards the YMCA on Monday afternoon from the university lot there, past the sink with the alligator eating the cow, which we rescue as we do every week and replace with a green tomato. The headless chicken, and the two flamingo families, mommy flamingo with 4 babies in the front yard, daddy flamingo with 28-year-old girlfriend flamingo in the backyard, around the corner and down that slope towards the stop sign, when 3 tall young men from Pioneer High School's cross-country team run past us. Little brother just picks up and starts running along after them, happily, easily, sweetly. He has his gray fuzzy gloves clipped to his coat, so as he runs, his gloves swing wildly. Tick-tock, tick-tock, flip-flop, flip-flop. He runs along with them about a block when one of the teenagers leans over and says something in a deep, my voice just changed sort of voice. And I feel sort of disappointed to see little brother suddenly pull up, his mouth open wide. When I finally catch up, I said, what did he say to you? He said, okay, 5 more miles. The dinner party. I'm having a dreadful dinner party. Wish you could come. Pompous boys from the university, skinny rich white ladies in pearls, idiot lawyers, tiresome engineers, all the important people I hate but am obliged to. I'm cooking all my super spectacular show-stopping signature specialties with sesame, the ones I can't stand to even taste. No paper plates for this one. It's the gold-rimmed china, the cut crystal glasses, the fancy Japanese chopsticks. I'm even cleaning the house like I never do for Chinese New Year's. But really, I'd much rather just lean over the back porch railing with you, a smuggled bottle of Chianti between us. No need for cups among friends. quiet bitching about all the inflated egos and stunted social skills inside, tender teasing, and of course, a punch in the arm when you invariably go too far. Remember when we were kids and we used to slip out the back door to escape Auntie Ling's world-famous stinky tofu? I can still see you, resplendent in your satin turquoise cape, so much more glamorous than my paisley orange cape, with matching orange headband. We would fly out the back gate, up into the sunburnt hills behind Auntie Ling's house, to our secret hideout behind the eucalyptus trees. There, you would stand on a rock, giving speeches, while I would fight off enemy marauders with the secret kung fu moves stolen from behind the curtain as my gong gong practiced every morning. We made up elaborate shows that we rehearsed over and over, but never actually performed for anyone. Hey, why was I always the dog? Mostly, we laughed and laughed in the tall, dry grass until the sun turned red and we heard the grown-ups calling, Xiao Mao! Xiao Hua! How I would love to be able to hop over the back porch railing with you, slip barefoot down the grassy slope to the creek below, clamber over boulders and stones, laughing and splashing in the dark, and then see you once again standing tall on a rock, a bottle of wine in one hand, the full moon's light like a spotlight as you sing some wacky Chinglish song just for me at the top of your lungs. I can almost see your satin turquoise cape still fluttering behind you in the breeze. I can even see our giggling and contrite return to the party. Everyone so busy with their what do? Where do you work? Ways of defining themselves that no one even noticed that I had slipped off into the past to who I once was. A trail of wet footprints on the tile, the only clue. Suddenly spring. Suddenly spring, colors bursting out of frame. Today is the Wizard of Oz, all technicolor in the sunshine. It has been so many years since I've been able to even see color. I henna my hair red and paint my toes pink. I pull on my orange coat, red socks, pointy-toed cowboy boots. Pause. And step out into the colors. For 12 hours, we walk together downtown in the rain, and for once, I do not talk about my troubles, do not vomit up all my terrible stories. For one vaguely familiar moment, I am myself again. No fear, no gossip, no noise, just lightness and laughter, and in this moment, searching for fairy doors on the arm of this beautiful and charming man. After he's gone, I go to my favorite Sweetwater's Cafe and tell everyone, from the baristas to the Persian graduate students, I went on a date! My daughter steals my cell phone and reads all his texts. Yikes. My friend, the New York Times bestselling author, winks and gives me a thumbs up. You went on a date and you're writing. I am writing for my life now, as my normal life threatens to resume. I do not want to go back to that grayscale world. I have to stay present in this moment, whatever it is. I am indignant to have to put on a suit and hose for another day wasted in court. I pull down my electric blue cowboy hat and I write, suddenly spring. So tell me your stories. Show me that you are real. Past the quiet of midnight, I go searching for you in my world, my virtual world, and you are not there. I suppose there are people without as much internet presence as me, but I fear that you do not exist, that you are illusion. I follow fleeting leads to find dentists with your name playing cricket in Iowa, and I know my name turns up countless pharmacists. Where are you? Who are you? In the daylight, I imagine how many times we might have unknowingly crossed paths, bicycling past the hospital in Tianjin, squeezing onto the train in Huhuote, crossing the bridge into Patan, buying a croissant in Chicago. Did you once hold a door for me in Detroit? Did I lend you a pen in Boston? Perhaps you are a ghost in the background of my stories. Perhaps I am a shadow in your photographs. I am curious. I'm not sure what to make of you or what you make of me. Our meeting was so brief, so unexpected, and now you are gone. I consider you an excuse in staying in the moment, to not get ahead of myself, to let things unfold as they will. But in holding back, I slowly forget the curve of your face, the smell of your skin, the easy click we both felt. Or so we claimed. Snow today, yet all is still sunshine. Things are starting to take off with me. Work is good, writing is good, home is good, art. All because you smiled at me from across the room? Life cannot be so easy, but I'll take it. Suddenly, I am who I'm supposed to be. Let's dance. The thought of you brings a smile to my lips throughout the day, often a smirk. I worry about becoming too fond of you, but I let that worry go. That you exist is enough. The possibility of you is enough to have jump-started me back into life, and life is unfurling faster than I could have imagined after having locked it away for so many years. I cannot believe the audacity with which you kissed me in front of the lecture hall. Your courage is infectious. I am delirious with nerve.